Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. It's that time of year where we take a look at what's happened. And Jim, you told me earlier that you've come up with a top 10 list of things that have been happening around the world. Could you just maybe give us a quick summary of what you think were the top 10 events the last year?
Yeah, this will run before the end of the year. And of course, in the second, I believe, we'll run our, you know, what was happening in the last 6 months of 2013. All right. The top 10 in no particular order. The Arab Spring turns red. Again, that's been in the news, but, you know, we give more detail. And the detail is, well, it's a good thing people drink towards the end of the year, because a lot of this stuff, at least in our department, is not encouraging at all. Basically, you know, all those uprisings failed one way or another. So there it goes. Number two, the Syrian civil war does not turn out as everyone expected. This was supposed to be a lot, you know, an old time Arab dictator, the majority of the population is rising up against him. But suddenly he's winning. How did that happen? Again, we've covered it in a lot of detail and there's more to come. Number three, Iran fools everyone again. Now, once Iran has been the big dog in its part of the world for thousands of years. You know, the Romans couldn't beat them. The Turks couldn't beat them. The Mongols did beat them, but then they left. The Iranians are a people that you should never count out. Last year in 2012, there was a new set of super sanctions against Iran because of its nuclear program. That is starting to crumble at the edges, and it looks like the Iranians may talk their way out of this. And the, you know, 20 years of clerical dictatorship continues to roll on in Iran. Number four, China rolls on one tiny victory after another. Again, people don't see this. You know, it's the forest and trees problem. The Chinese have been grabbing chunks of India and the South China Sea, you know, actually for over a decade, but in the last few years, they've really, you know, speeded it up as much as a snail can speed up. I mean, they've been going faster at it, but basically it's a war of little victories, and none of the victories are important enough to the victims to go to war over. So China just grabs a little bit, you know, maybe stops for a little bit, and then keeps coming. It's really, you know, crazy, and the Chinese are winning. Number five, Iraq finds a way to squander democracy. In 2011, when the United States forces left, or actually were forced out by the Iraqis who didn't want to sign a status of forces agreement to keep some American troops in Iraq, as many Iraqis wanted, but it became a political football in Iraq, and the government would not sign the standard agreement that American troops live by when they're in a foreign country. And things have gone downhill, you know. Terrorism is way up. Corruption is way up. Economic progress is slowing down. You know, basically, it's all falling apart. And that's we covered that a lot. A lot of interesting details. You know, if you're not depressed enough at the end of the year, this will push you right over the edge. Now, one bright spot, number six, France finds glory. French love glory. In a distant desert. Who knew? The French had it in it. You know, kudos to the French. They suddenly, out of nowhere, more or less, led an invasion of northern Mali, which had turned into a Al-Qaeda, you know, sanctuary. Everybody was dithering, you know, in Africa and in Europe and what have you, or what to do, what to do. And the French just said, hey, here's what you do. It's not working out exactly the way the French would like, but close enough. It's a win for the French, and they get precious few of those. Number seven, North Korea proves again why it is better to be feared than loved. North Korea has been in the dumps ever since the Cold War ended and the Russian subsidies disappeared, which were propping up the government and the economy for decades. They had a massive famine, which killed 10% of the population. The economy's gone to pieces. It's just a total disaster. And recently, the North Korean government has come up with a new solution. Let's have more firing squads. Let's shoot more people in public executions. That's the ticket. And the latest victim of the firing squads was the guy who was thought to be the number two man. He was the uncle of the current leader, the third of the Kim dynasty. And the uncle's apparent sin was he was catting around. And, of course, the his wife is the sister of the late Kim Jong-il's, the father of the current head of North Korea. And I suspect there's more soap opera than politics involved in that. You know, it's really old school. Who says medieval, politics is dead? It's alive and well in North Korea. Number eight, the UN again finds that fighting for peace works. After 10 years of peacekeeping, this has been the biggest peacekeeping operation in UN history. And they've got nothing to show for it. They finally decide, well, why don't we try being offensive? You know, they basically, somebody in the UN found, they had a pair, it was hidden in a drawer somewhere, and they said, let's try this, let's be nasty. So they formed a brigade of combat troops and said, go there and fight those militias who refuse to basically stop, harassing people and making the mess of Eastern Congo. And it worked! Within months, the threat was gone. Who knows what's going to come out of that? Probably, a disbanding of the brigade and back to the business as usual. And 10, this is something, again, that's in the news, but people don't realize the import of it, the death of secrecy. Between the Chinese internet espionage and the many freelancers whom the Chinese use and will sell the secrets to anybody who's willing to pay, and, of course, the activists in the American government, Bradley Manning and Mr. Snowden, and there are others, and other governments as well, but especially in America, because we basically listen to everybody, in an intelligence sense at least. There are no secrets anymore. Yeah, and this is actually a trend that has been going on since World War II. It used to be you could really keep secrets. But if you study the history of secrets and espionage, you'll see that with the invention of computers, and especially the internet, you can successfully spy much quicker and much more effectively. Because, that's what a computer does. It allows you to do whatever you're doing, for better or worse, faster. And people don't realize that it works. And this is why, anybody who's thinking of secrecy in any aspect of their lives, and I'm not just talking about the government, I'm talking about the marketing people, who I think will be the next generation of movie, the heavies in the next generation of movies. We've wore the Nazis out. You can't use commies anymore. You can't do China, because then China will, ruin your economy. North Korea makes a sad, substitute. But marketing men, think about it. Think about it. Anyway, most people don't think about it, and it just happens, and they wake up one day and realize that, somebody flipped their laptop camera on, has been watching them for the last month. And, so it goes.
So, Austin, what do you have to add to that? That's quite a list.
Well, I think Jim went through nine, because I'm going to clue our audience out there. We usually do strategy page just right off the cuff, but for this special program, Jim came up with his list of 10, and that also included, I think, I didn't hear it, Jim, but you mentioned Russia discovers the legacy of the USSR as poisonous. They've had a decade of trying to reform their military.
Okay.
But that said, let me go through it. Arab Spring turns rancid. I disagree that Tunisia is a failure. Jim's overall view is great. I love the headline, because it communicates so much so quickly. But we're really not going to know, Dan, for sure, about Tunisia and Egypt for three decades. Remember, these are all discrete revolutions. We gather them into the Arab Spring, so it's easier to, quote-unquote, talk about. Libya is a mess for a number of reasons. Let's go to his number two. Jim's number two was the Syrian civil war does not turn out as everyone expected. No, it hasn't. I agree right now that Assad is winning, and he shouldn't have, but there are a number of reasons. Fragmented leadership on NATO's part, because I've seen this as a shadow war between NATO and Iran. I think it still is, and that has to do with Jim's number three, Iran fools everyone again. No, I'm sorry, folks, it hadn't fooled everybody. If you go look at the Quick and Dirty Guide to War, third edition. I'm doing that one off the top of my head. You can see what Jim and I had to say about Iran and its quest, the Ayatollah's quest for unconventional weapons, even in the mid-90s. They haven't changed. Jim had a point about the way China is rolling on one tiny victory after another. Iran has been playing a delay game for almost, two decades. And they get away with it. And a delay is a type of tiny victory, Stan. They've been doing it.
Right.
And part of it, what they play on, is a desire on the part of certain Western governments. I'm not just talking about the United States here. Certain Western governments to have the appearance of a diplomatic success. And in lieu of a nuclear war in the Middle East, or even potentially a nuclear war in Europe, because the Iranians have the could have the ability to hit parts of Europe with a missile. China rolls on one tiny victory after another. There was a interesting article about a week or 10 days ago. Jim, I've meant to send you a URL to it. I don't think I did, but it was basically titled "China is playing a game." And the comparison in it was, you know, like chess or Go, you know, little moves. I thought, well, it's really more complex. It's like some of the old Simulations Publications Inc. games. But the way Jim has covered this on Strategy Page, and the way I've written about it, because I did about three Creator Syndicate columns on China this year, is death by a thousand cuts. Jim calls it little victories. Recall in the early 1990s, Serbia's what I call their war of creeping aggression, where they would take a little nick out of Bosnia and then stop as the UN and the European Union went crazy, and then it would all die down because folks didn't want to intervene. Well, China, to some degree, is doing that on a strategic scale with the whole of Asia, and Jim pointed that out. Iraq finds a way to squander democracy. I think the U.S. has U.S. is in its own way is as guilty as the Iraqi government on the failure to get the troop extension in 2011. But he's Jim's right. What the Iraqi ambassador to Afghanistan said when he said "Don't kick the Americans out," that's a backhanded victory for the United States. France finds glory in a distant desert. Well, France is finding glory in lots of places, Dan. France has begun acting like an adult in lieu of leading from behind for the United States. Notice the number of and we've written about this on Strategy Page, too. The European defense ministers calling for air-to-air refueling capability. More long-range transport. NATO does have a small C-17 squadron, and it's leased, isn't it, Jim? And about
yes.
three or four aircraft, it's leased.
Yes.
But that gives them a minimal a capability. My own thinking about this, they need at least a dozen, okay? That's good for U.S. business on that, but they need at least a dozen to be able to support some of these operations in Africa. But the French have stepped up. North Korea proves again why it's better to be feared than loved. I think an alternative read is that all is not so secure in Pyongyang, but Jim might come back and say, hey, Austin, all is never so secure in Pyongyang. It's a hereditary communist dictatorship. I will note that communism, at least in China, has changed, and based on what I have read since the execution, Uncle Jiang seemed to be a pal of China. I don't know how that plays out. I think the explanation that Kim Jong-un's aunt got kicked at her husband catting around, that plays with me. It's more like a good Molière play or something, you know, on Shakespeare. I understand that. UN again finds fighting for peace works. As Jim's pointed this out two or three times this year, and I appreciate it about how Austin's been writing about this for decades. If you really want to peacekeep, at times you've got to have the huevos to make peace. I've written a lot about the intervention brigade, and I think it was put together intelligently. The centerpieces of it were a Tanzanian jungle infantry battalion and a South African infantry battalion. It was supposed to have a Malawi battalion that never showed up, but they put together a small, highly competent reconnaissance recon company, recon element, they call it. I still don't have the goods on what was in their artillery support. I know it was at least a battery, and they were very effective. They had managed to bring their surveillance and reconnaissance and intelligence assets together to be able to use that fire support element, and they demonstrated in August of this year that they could really bring fire heavily on the M23 guerrillas that had been so frustrating the Congolese army. And then in the final offensive, or near final offensive, at least what broke the M23 enclave at the end of October and early November, based on what I've been able to learn, there really wasn't so much direct involvement by the two mainline infantry battalions, but they provided fire support. I know they provided intelligence and reconnaissance support, and that made a heck of a difference. Plus, they showed that you could beat M23, and they were there on the battlefield. So Jim's right. Old-style peacekeeping, you know, may be out, and I noticed that the French have a similar mandate for offensive operations in the Central African Republic. We've written about that on Strategy Page. I had a column a couple of weeks ago. Russia discovers legacy of Soviet Union is poisonous. Don't tell Vladimir Putin, but Jim Donegan is right. Death of secrecy. I think the way that this has been presented on Strategy Page is most instructive. And the way, notice Jim said, let's start with World War II. Well, you might be able to start actually with 1914, and knowing that one of the first things the British did after the war started was go out and hack the German undersea cables. Now, that was to get into their diplomatic traffic. Part of that was the Royal Navy wanted to know where the German cruisers in the Pacific were, see if they could get some hints on that. But certainly since World War II and the escalation, acceleration of electronic intelligence capabilities, we're giving you the history on it. It's not something that Mr. Snowden just brought to fore. I love his comment of turning marketing people into heavies. I've just come up with a plot, Jim. I already see the first. So there you go, Dan.
Yeah, well, I mean, boy, I don't know where you could get a better summary than that. Now, my one thing that I want to add, and maybe you guys will set me straight on this, but, you know, we're still in a very dangerous world. Things are happening out there. And the U.S. has started to accelerate their drawdown. The sequester has continued to hurt. And my big worry is the drawdown on the boots on the ground side, which, you know, we're eliminating a bunch of brigades and drawing down 80,000 in the U.S. Army. And I saw a piece in one of the journals the other day that the U.S. military is going back to their old ideas of trying to do everything from a standoff position rather than actually putting boots into areas that we may need to put boots in. What are your feelings on that, Jim?
Well, there is also a truism in politics that if you don't have soldiers, you can't use them, you know, to get into trouble. The foreign affairs crowd is divided on the issue of intervening or not intervening. In times past, when there was a lot less money to basically have a military, you know, capable of intervention around the world, and this is a relatively recent phenomenon. You know, it was basically during the 18th century that European powers, mainly, you know, in support of trade, developed the capability of going around literally on the other side of the world and applying military pressure. But they quickly found out that it's enormously expensive. And unless there's enough plunder, as it were, unless there's enough stuff you can steal or whatever, in that enterprise, you cannot do it. And the world economy has enormously grown in the last 200 years. And with it has come more, governments have invented more taxes. They've had more money to play with, and we've seen how they play with it. But they've also discovered that, as some voters have discovered, that if you don't give them the money, they can't spend it. Well, they have a harder time spending it. You've got to cut off their ability to borrow, et cetera, et cetera. These little bastards, you know, they keep trying. Because basically, the easiest way to get reelected is to promise to give people something. And to do that, you need money, whether it's taxes or borrowing. And that's one of the flaws in democracy. I mean, again, this is why Churchill said democracy is the worst possible form of government, except for all the others. But it is a weakness in democracy. And in military affairs, it can basically turn, you can leverage in the wrong direction. In military operations, they become enormously expensive. I mean, you know, Iraq was supposed to pay for itself. Well, it ended up costing $1 trillion. Afghanistan, well, that was another issue because, you know, nobody ever really seriously considered going into Afghanistan. I mean, it's landlocked, for God's sake. And the main access points are Iran, which is no go for Americans, and Pakistan, which is an ally of China, which is no longer much of a friend of the United States. Be that as it may, if you don't have troops ready and to go, you can't go. You can't even think of going because there's nothing to go with. So the idea of cutting the boots on the ground is very popular with a lot of politicians and a lot of taxpayers who can think about it, because it means the government won't be tempted to intervene, even though the intervention might have a serious, you know, humanitarian, you know, impact. You know, the French have simply said, recently said, I mean, just in the last week, that to the African states, we're not the policemen of Africa. All right, we'll go into the, we'll send 1,000 or so troops into the Central African Republic, but that's it, pal. You guys got to, you know, organize your own police force because you live in a rough neighborhood, and if you don't defend yourselves, we're not going to do it. And the Americans aren't going to do it. Nobody's going to do it. Even the Chinese won't do it. They'll come in and sell you guns, but they won't, you know, basically defend anybody. And this is something a lot of Americans, whether they vocalize it or not, are behind, this idea of not getting involved all over the world. Now, in the last 50 years since World War II, you've had the growth of media, which found it very profitable to publicize the tragedies around the world, the tragedies that could be alleviated with some American intervention. And I'm not talking about money, although that often helps, but not really. But, you know, military force. And I think the turning point in that was, I mean, some people say it was Korea and Vietnam, but really I think it was Somalia in 1993. I mean, literally, we've been in there because of pictures coming out showing people starving to death, which they were, which they do and have been doing for thousands of years. But now we have television, you know, and people basically, when they starve to death on live TV, that impresses people. And they said, let's go in. And we went in, we got in the middle of, the Somalis are not the sort of people that are easy to help. We quickly got out. And nobody's gotten back in since. Well, the Ethiopians have, but they're neighbors. So same with the Kenyans. But even they, being neighbors, would prefer to stay out. There are some places, there are a lot of places, I'd say most places, you don't want to go into. Again, stand off, do what you can, you know, send regrets, wring your hands, write editorials, opinion pieces, but don't send troops. Because it's a fool's errand, and it usually doesn't work, at least not the way you expect it to.
Austin, your comments?
Well, this is as complicated an issue, Dan, as exists. It's, if I may say so, it's even more complicated than health care, or, excuse me, health insurance on this. I know that'll really throw some of our listeners. But look, biggest threat I think the United States faces, actually the biggest threat the world faces, is what we call strategic debt. A good way to bring that into the defense discussion is see Greek Navy reference submarines. Their submarines don't have the money to keep the new German subs. They've had to scrap some of them, can't afford it. We are experiencing a similar decline here in the U.S. But let's talk about ground troops just for a second. There's an article that I wrote that appeared in the San Antonio Express News in a Sunday paper. It was called Grunt Work, and it showed up one Sunday in August of 2001. And while Jim was talking, I was thinking, I'm going to call the Express News and see if I can get a copy of it. Maybe they'll let us put it up on Strategy Page, because it got picked up by the Early Bird, which is the Pentagon's clipping service. It resulted in some letters to the Early Bird saying that Austin Bay was a Luddite, because I said there are only certain things where troops matter. It really had a T.R. Fehrenbach line to it. Ted Fehrenbach died a couple of weeks ago. This kind of war, I think, is the finest history of the Korean War. But Fehrenbach notes that the only certain times in war, because both the psychological import, the moral commitment that you get when you're with ground troops. And by the way, Fehrenbach lived in San Antonio, and he read the article, and he talked to me about it. He thought he liked it a great deal. But I was a Luddite until 9/11, which was when I suddenly didn't look like so much of a Luddite. At some time, you need troops. At the same time, force structure, there are a lot of things that technology provides now. Drones, as an example, they're not really drones, but unmanned aerial vehicles are long-range snipers doing things that are a lot easier than us having a sniper team in the Himalayas to do. And that's a different kind of force mix. But to some degree, too, cuts in forces are easier to make than certain other types of government government cuts. And let me be kind of parochial here for a moment. Yes, I get a retired pay because I spent, 5 on active and 27 reserves, 32 years. So I get, at age 60, I start getting retired pay. Hey, wait a minute. That's supposed to be a pension. No, the way it is with the military is that that's retired pay, deferred pay for all of what you put up with in the time that you deployed or did whatever you did. But notice how it's often pictured out there as pensions. Well, maybe it's in a gray zone. But one of the things is that some veterans' benefits are benefits. You might even call them the original entitlements, Dan. Because a lot of entitlement programs, a number of them, are ultimately modeled, even though the folks advocating them don't know it, on what were defense or veterans programs. Bruce Porter's War and the Rise of the State, which appeared about 94 or 95 or so, does a great job of documenting that. There are about 4 or 5 chapters in there that would just shock a number of the entitlements, and I'll say liberal or left-wing entitlements advocates, if they knew that they were modeled on military programs. But the historical fact is there. Get on some of the websites where you see veterans, retirees, and the like discussing cuts in veterans' medical programs, and they're different ones, and it's not just TRICARE. And I was struck recently. And I don't remember which page it was on, but let me paraphrase it, because it really did a good job of describing the way a number of veterans see these cuts. And why am I discussing it? Because it ultimately affects your ability to attract and recruit quality soldiers so that you got a quality ground force. That's why I'm going through this. And this fellow identified himself as retired senior non-com, identified himself as a sergeant major. So I'm guessing he was either Marine or Army. And he says, our debt problem is huge, and I'm prepared to accept cuts in retired pay. You have to understand that. But he says, why is it that I feel like I'm taking it? And he says, I know I'm taking it because I'm in the service and I'm still a soldier, and it's easier to get to me than, and here's what he said, it was politically volatile. I'm not saying that it's politically correct. I don't see cuts in services for illegal immigrants. I don't see some of the other stuff. No. I'm an easy target. And I told my wife about that, and she says, well, the man's actually expressing very eloquently a reaction that's a legitimate reaction. Now, where's this lead? That's when I said it was a complicated problem. We recognize that unsustainable debt is a threat to the entirety of society, economically, certainly a threat on the defense side. And if you accept, just take the caveats Jim said, but you accept at some point the Ted Fehrenbach grunt work argument that you got to have quality ground troops. Let's go back to the UN Intervention Brigade. What really made that go wasn't that artillery battery. You go run that. That was great. But also having those two crack infantry battalions that you were going to have to tangle with their assault rifles and grenade launchers, and the fact that they were disciplined troops. Don't laugh at the Tanzanians. That Tanzanian unit was front line. And the South African units got the tradition of South African infantry forces behind it. Excellent. You're going to have them. And how do you have them? It's a very complex, and this is something that Jim was alluding to earlier, time-consuming process to produce a high-quality soldier if you don't already have them. Got to keep them in being, got to pay them.
Right, and that's my concern is, yeah, and we've talked about it before, is that we're losing a lot of institutional knowledge with losing our NCOs, our senior NCOs and like that. Well, it's going to continue to be a dangerous world. Next time we talk to everyone, we'll be talking to you about what we see coming in the next year. Not necessarily prognostication, but we'll be talking about just general trends that we see, because we try not to predict here, because that's such a tough thing to do. One of the things I'd like to do is give a call out to our listeners to share this with your friends. Make sure people know about Strategy Page. The more visitors we have, the more successful we can be, and we can keep bringing you new stuff. And I'd like to wish everybody a Happy New Year and a Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah if you're of another faith. And thanks for working with me, guys, and we'll see you next year.
Happy holidays.
Bye, Dan. Yep.
Bye.